Welcome to the AVA Journal Legal Rebels podcast, where we talk to men and women who are remaking the legal profession, changing the way the law is practiced, and setting standards that will guide us into the future.
The legal profession lacks diversity. In other news, the sun is hot, law school is expensive, and junk food is bad for you. Not to be facetious, but the lack of diversity when it comes to race, gender, sexuality, disability, and social class within the legal profession is nothing new. However, the last decade has actually marked a gradual increase in diversity across all fields. For instance, according to the most recent ABA profile of the legal profession, while women only make up 39% of the lawyers in this country despite being over 50% of the population, that percentage is actually an increase compared to where it was 10 or even 20 years ago. Meanwhile, racial minorities only make up 20% of the lawyers in the country, but that's also an improvement over 10 years ago when it was only 11%. And there are similar trends when it comes to sexual orientation and disability. However, diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, or DEI for short, have come under attack lately. Last year, the Supreme Court struck down affirmative action programs in college admissions, and several groups have started challenging the legality of DEI programs at law firms and companies. Are we looking at an undoing of all the progress that's been made over the last few decades to make the legal profession more diverse? My name is Victor Lee, and I'm Assistant Managing Editor of the ABA Journal. My guests today are Lisa Kirby and Kavita Ramakrishnan of Diversity Lab. Lisa is President of Inclusive Talent Systems there, while Kavita serves as Mansfield Rule and Knowledge Sharing Senior Director. They're here today to talk about diversity in the legal profession and where DEI efforts might be heading in this post-Harvard landscape. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. That's great to be here.
Yeah, so obviously I just gave very, very quick elevator version of your bios. So can you tell us a little bit about yourselves and your backgrounds? Maybe Kavita first and then Lisa?
Sure. So I grew up in a small town in Massachusetts, and I practiced law for about 10 years. I first practiced at a large law firm and then a mid-sized firm. And part of the reason I went to law school is I cared very deeply about fairness. That's something that's mattered a lot to me throughout my life. And as it does, as many other people care about it as well, I'm sure. But I decided to actually transition to work at Diversity Lab with my colleague Lisa, because I realized I was more interested in the way that the systems that we were working in were unfair, the lack of fairness in those systems themselves versus, you know, trying to play in within that system and create fairness there. So I found myself at Diversity Lab in order to try to fix those systems.
And Lisa?
Sure. Hi. I, like Kavita, am a recovering lawyer. I now have about 25 years of experience in the legal field. I started out as a practicing lawyer in two large firms and then worked in talent and diversity for many years at another large firm. And I've done a couple other things in the legal field, but I've been at Diversity Lab now for 8 years, and I was drawn to work here because it was a really inspiring opportunity to work with our founder and CEO, Karen Ulrich Stacey, whose career I had followed for a long time, and to work on actually making a difference in some of the same systems and issues I had experienced personally and observed in my prior law firms.
Gotcha. I think we all kind of use that recovering lawyer term, but to kind of piggyback off that, I mean, you talked a little bit about this just now, but like, what made the two of you decide to just devote your professional lives to promoting diversity in the legal profession? I mean, there are all kinds of things you guys could have done, you know, to help better the lives of lawyers or to improve conditions or whatnot. What made you focus on that issue specifically?
I'd always been interested in issues of equity and fairness throughout college, law school, and when I was practicing. I was very aware of differences in the way people were treated. I also had the opportunity to practice at two very different large firms and experienced how the differences in culture affected diversity. It was in the leadership specifically. One firm had very few partners that were not men or were not white. It had a very different culture than the other firm. And that was really interesting to me. It's just always been something that I have noticed and been aware of. I was raised by a mom who was a very devoted feminist and taught me about these things from the time I was young and really encouraged me to be aware of the differences in the way that women and men were treated and also underrepresented individuals and others. So something that I've just always had a radar about. And I was always involved in mentoring and other initiatives at my firm. So that was sort of my initial involvement. And then when I started working, I worked at Goodwin as in the professional development team and helped support the diversity committee and helped launch the women's initiative there. And from there, started to do a lot more research and became much more informed about sort of the data side of it and statistics. And so that kind of filled out my understanding of my sort of personal anecdotal experience and what I knew generally about the workplace and equality and fairness. So I started actually doing the work to promote equality and fairness and gender equity and racial equity through my work on those with those teams and committees and partners. And so when I found out about Diversity Lab, when they launched the OnRamp Fellowship before I joined, and I just thought that was an absolutely brilliant idea. It's a reentry platform for people who have taken time away from practicing. 72% of people that take a hiatus are women from practicing, and they do sometimes struggle to get back into full-time practice. And so it was really inspirational to me because I had been spending years working with these groups and just reading a lot of statistics about how the legal profession was so slow to diversify and was so not inclusive, and the stats were similar year after year and a little bit depressing. And I saw that the OnRamp Fellowship was a new innovative idea that was taking action to change the status quo. And I thought it was so exciting. And then when I saw a job opportunity come up here, I realized this is the place I want to be because it's where we're actually taking action and testing out solutions. We're all aware of the problems. They're longstanding and at this point very well documented, but we are oriented towards testing out and innovating new solutions. So I think that describes my career path a little bit more in depth and why I decided to come to Diversity Lab.
Gotcha. And did you want to add anything, Kavita? Or?
Sure. You know, very similar to Lisa, I think this, you know, the idea of DEI and creating a world that understands differences amongst people and really respects them, that's something that's been on my radar since childhood as well. I think I've always been very interested in the difference between how you might feel as an individual and how you might be perceived externally and how that can lead to people treating you differently, either in very innocuous ways, you know, whether it's you're left-handed versus someone assuming you're right-handed, or something that can be more insidious, you know, leads to discrimination or harm. I think that conflict has always been something that's really resonated with me personally. And so, you know, in college, I was involved in a lot of groups that were trying to raise the voices of underrepresented groups. And in law school, I was a critical race theory. I specialize in critical race theory. And I, you know, practiced law thinking that I could fight for fairness that way. And, you know, maybe I was thinking, I think ultimately maybe I'd want to become a public interest lawyer. But, you know, I realized that the actual, you know, systems that we were fighting within, I was far more interested in addressing the deficiencies there than in trying to fight within what I felt was a broken system. And so I found myself trying to figure out, you know, once I left big law, how do I find a job that allows me to feel like I'm making systemic change? And I got extremely lucky in the process finding out about Diversity Lab. They came on my radar as an organization that cared deeply about making actionable change to creating more inclusive work environments that is fully based, that's evidence-based and data-based and innovative. And it actually, you know, we partner with law firms and legal departments and that are actually interested in doing this work with us. And all of those aspects and being able to work with, you know, brilliant people like Lisa and our CEO and founder, Karen Ulrich Stacey, was just a wonderful opportunity that seemed to align my core interests from childhood with my professional path.
Gotcha. So let me ask about, obviously, having covered this for a little while. Yeah, I've seen pipeline programs for diversity initiatives, mentorships, client mandates, and whatnot. How successful would you rate these as far as helping to diversify the legal industry?
So I think that, you know, diversity programs take a number of different forms. I don't think any one diversity program DEI initiative is going to fix everything. When we're talking about DEI, we're talking about creating fairness in a variety of systems, whether it's, you know, recruiting, whether we're looking at promotion, whether we're looking at equal access to information. It takes many, many, many different forms, and it kind of requires a whole bunch of different interventions in order for things to become more equitable and inclusive. So I think each of those programs have their place, and in each of those cases, you want to make sure that they are there's accountability there. There is an opportunity for iteration. There's an opportunity to look at what's working and what isn't. Each of those programs can work if there are proper structures in place, and they can work for particular purposes. That's, I think, my take on this.
Gotcha. So I had mentioned the Mansfield Rule very briefly in the intro. Could you explain what is it and what does it obligate people to do if they sign on to it?
Sure. So the Mansfield Rule asks law firms and legal departments to consider a certain percentage of candidates for leadership roles, promotions, and senior level hiring. And it also asks organizations to be more transparent about how to get into these roles and what is the pathway to leadership in your organization. How does it all work to kind of demystify all that and eliminate the sort of phenomenon that tends to happen where an in-group tends to be more plugged in or more aware of how it all works, especially when it's more of an unwritten rule or unwritten policy. And then an out-group, whoever is not in the majority, does not have the same access to all that kind of inside scoop. So it's transparency and then considering a broader talent pool. So it's intended to open the door wider to leadership and ensuring that opportunities for advancement are inclusive for everyone. And how it came about is Diversity Lab pulled together a hackathon, the first ever legal hackathon. It was the Women in Law Hackathon in 2016 at Stanford Law School. And the idea was to bring together over 50 law firm leaders and DEI experts to hack solutions to gender equity in the law. The same idea I was talking about before, where it's an issue. There was an issue of women being slower to advance into leadership in the profession. At the time, I think women were either 16 or 18% equity partners when they had been half of law school classes for over a decade. So there was a discrepancy there, and it's something that had been talked about for a long time. And there were some programs to try to address it, but the needle hadn't really moved. So that was the idea of the Women in Law Hackathon. The winner of the crowd favorite award was the Mansfield Rule at that event. And we at Diversity Lab took the sort of shell of the idea, which was the consideration of 30%, and expanded it further into a fuller framework and added the transparency element. And we were very fortunate that many of the firms who had participated in the hackathon were willing to give it a try and test it out with us for the inaugural pilot in 2017. So that's how it came about. I'm trying to think if there's something I feel like there's something I'm leaving out. But oh, I should clarify, though, this was the Women in Law Hackathon, but we expanded the Mansfield Rule from the beginning to include underrepresented racial and ethnic groups in the law, because there is, if you look at the stats, it's also the legal profession has also been very slow to diversify at the leadership levels although law schools have reflected more or less the diversity of the population for 10 to 20 years, depending on the specific demographic group, the leadership has remained very not diverse, and even still to this day, although some progress has been made, so especially in the last few years.
Gotcha. All right, so before we continue, let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
If you're like me, you're probably a bit frustrated with the state of our political system today. Democracy Decoded, a podcast by Campaign Legal Center, examines our government and discusses innovative ideas that could lead to a stronger, more transparent, accountable, and inclusive democracy. Listen at democracydecoded.org to their new season, which takes a deep dive into democracy at the state and local level by highlighting different ways to ensure that every voter's voice is heard.
Delegate out those tasks that take up your time. Staffy can help you with your legal, administrative, marketing, and even client-facing workload. Hiring Staffy's top-notch bilingual virtual staff means Staffy does the recruiting, hiring, and training for you. Then, if you need a change, Staffy handles it. You get to concentrate on your strategic work. Schedule a free consultation at staffy.cc. That's STAFI.cc and get $500 off with code HAPPY24.
And we're back. So let's talk about the elephant in the room. Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard was the culmination of a long battle against affirmative action in college admissions. And then some groups immediately seized on that ruling to then challenge diversity initiatives in employment, including at law firms. So how has the legal sector reacted to the ruling and some of these challenges?
So we can talk about, I think, what we've seen with the firms that we work with as part of the Mansfield rule. And what we've seen there actually has been quite heartening. They've really looked at what that case actually says, which it actually, you know, the case does not directly impact workplace initiatives since it was decided in the, you know, as part of college admission. So it's in the educational sphere. But they looked at that ruling and they, you know, took it very seriously, as they should, but recognized that it didn't have an immediate impact on their workplace DEI initiatives. And, you know, the risk really comes from for people trying to take that case and make it apply to the workplace, which, you know, there have been multiple attempts at people trying to do so over the past year. And firms are, you know, trying to prepare for themselves for that specifically, like let's trying to shore up what their existing DEI programs to make sure that they can withstand, you know, any attacks that might be coming, or at least as many attacks as possible going forward. But the big picture being that they are really digging deeper into their DEI programs, continuing to participate in Mansfield, and really reaffirming their commitment to engaging in DEI work amid this particular challenging time, which is really, I think, a good sign.
And what is the current status of the Mansfield rule? Is it going to be modified or changed at all, or do you feel confident in its foundations that it would survive any kind of challenge?
Well, we're not lawyers, so we can't speak legally. We're no longer lawyers, but the Mansfield rule has always been within the bounds of the law. It does not mandate quotas or require talent decisions to be made on any basis that would be legally invalid. It's just about opening the door wider and broadening the talent pool for consideration for different positions and ensuring, you know, opportunities are inclusive. So it was, you know, lawful when it was established. Actually, the team that I mentioned, the Women in Law Hackathon, that team that created the Mansfield rule included some labor and employment lawyers, and it has been blessed subsequently by teams of labor and employment lawyers as well. And it remains lawful today. So it's functioning well, it's functioning as intended, and we have no plans to change it. As Kavita mentioned, the law firms and legal departments participating have remained steadfastly committed as well, in recognition of the fact that it is very effective in making things fairer and more inclusive, and that it remains completely lawful. So no plans to change it. Although we do, I should say, we update the Mansfield rule every year to make sure it's functioning as effectively as possible. But that's just part of our approach, which uses design thinking principles
to test things out and then iterate as needed, but nothing related to all of this sort of legal circus around in the educational context.
And just kind of talking generally, I mean, obviously there's an undercurrent or perception here that the idea that DEI lets in unqualified or inferior candidates at the expense of qualified ones. So what are ways that you can combat or change that perception?
Well, I mean, this with the statement itself, I think it's, you know, there are a number of assumptions underlying that particular perception that need to definitely be addressed. And the first, I think, is, you know, the idea that if a candidate is underrepresented in some way, that they are unqualified or inferior. That's the underlying sentiment in that particular question, which is itself is problematic, as well as the fact that the idea that the current system is fair and that it's working. And I think that first part, by addressing that issue, can go a long way. Just, you know, talking people through the details of this system that people assume is leading to a meritocracy. DEI is intended to ensure that there is fairness and that this idea of meritocracy is indeed a meritocracy. People that are actually, well, most qualified are getting, you know, being able to move forward versus people who are less qualified. That's ultimately what DEI is trying to do. They're completely compatible ideas. And the idea that, you know, talking to people about the systems that are in place and the fact that, you know, let's think about hiring. You know, we are hiring from certain pools of individuals. We are not, you know, we are only looking at X, Y, and Z places. Then when we bring them into the fold, we ask them these types of questions. And based on, you know, Y criteria, we decide we're going to move people on to the next level. And if you talk to people on how the way that actually works and whether there are, you know, thoughtful, intentional decisions being made about where people are looking for candidates or who's getting promoted, things like that, I think people really understand the idea that there might not be as much thought being put into a lot of these systems as they originally thought. It might not be as much of a quote unquote meritocracy as they think, as they originally thought. And I think breaking all that down and making people realize that these systems could be better, and they could be better, not just, you know, in a vacuum, they could be better for everyone so that they themselves can actually move forward as well. That can be one way to get at things. And then also just generally the idea of helping them realize that there are very, you know, people from all different backgrounds can be brilliant. And the fact that they don't exist in that person's particular experience for whatever reason doesn't mean that they don't exist. So, you know, addressing the larger issue of people's lack of exposure to people of different backgrounds that might bring value to the table. Those are, I think, at least two ways to start addressing the issue. But the issue, again, being about DEI, being about fairness and making people realize that this is ultimately about making sure that people who are the most qualified are actually getting the opportunities that they deserve. I think that idea of fairness really does resonate with the average person, regardless of their background.
And I think, too, if I could just add something, I think that mathematically, statistically, if you have a larger candidate pool, you're going to have more qualified applicants or candidates, not less. So I think it's a mistake to start with the premise that having a narrower candidate pool who is often in the legal world, and not just to pick on law firms. I mean, so there are other industries that are like this, but where a lot of hiring, especially lateral hiring or lateral partner hiring, is based on somebody's organic network and who they happen to know, which is constrained by, you know, a set of, you know, their specific circumstances, where they live, the places they go, the activities they partake in. And so, by expanding that a bit and adding some deliberative thinking to it. So just adding some processes. Kavita was talking about the systems that are in place. And I think one issue with them is that a lot of the hiring practices are more informal and organic. And we know from decades of research that more informal, fast-moving processes tend to allow in more bias. And so we know there's a book called Thinking Fast and Slow by a Nobel Prize winner, Daniel Kahneman, who recently passed away. But in his book, he talks about how fast thinking is just, that's your instinctive reaction to things. And that is, it just tends to have more cognitive biases, not necessarily prejudice against a particular group, just cognitive biases that our brains employ to help us move through things quickly. And it's helpful when you're like driving and trying to avoid, you know, getting in an accident. It's not so helpful when you're considering who is the most qualified candidate for something or whether you've brought in a broad enough candidate pool. So the idea of adding a little bit more deliberative thinking to, for example, the hiring or promotion process actually means that everyone's making sure they're broadening their field of consideration and making sure they are looking at the most qualified pool of candidates rather than just who comes to mind most quickly, which is often who you spoke to most recently or saw most recently. It's called recency bias, or who you sit near or who you live near, which is proximity bias. All of these things come into play when we're not engaging in deliberative thinking. So I just wanted to add that comment.
Gotcha. All right. So let's take a quick break for another word from our sponsor. And we're back. So if I have a law firm and I want to craft a DEI policy that could withstand, you know, a potential legal challenge, but also just one that you think would be very effective in helping to address some of the structural issues that you mentioned earlier, how would you recommend that I go about doing that?
Well, since we're not lawyers, practicing lawyers, we can't really give legal advice on that. So I would say...
This is more business advice.
I mean, I do think a good DEI policy, putting aside the question of withstanding a legal challenge, a good DEI approach definitely has accountability and structure built in. I think one of the shortcomings of many well-intentioned DEI policies or game plans is that they tend to be big on ideas and exciting announcements and developments, and they tend to be delivered with a lot of hoopla and genuine excitement, but they tend to fizzle sometimes when there's a lack of accountability and structure built in. So people's priorities shift around all the time. In law firms, there are also many other very important things top of mind for people. They're serving clients. There's other urgent issues that arise. And so if there's not a structure and an accountability, you know, guardrail built in, then I do think that a lot of DEI policies tend to slip people's minds and tend to sort of slowly fizzle out if there's no built-in way to keep them top of mind for people. And there are a lot of great ways you can do this. I don't want to just harp on the Mansfield rule. I will just say that that's in line also with some of the behavioral science I was mentioning earlier, that to really make a change, an organizational change stick, you need to build in an accountability piece and a way to make it sustainable and keep it top of mind. We all know that New Year's resolutions tend to go by the wayside, you know, once January turns to February and our minds kind of tend to drift to other things. So it's the same idea. You need to build in something such as third-party accountability or group accountability, which is one function of the Mansfield rule, is that everyone's certified every year. It keeps them accountable. It's not just a form you fill out at the end of the year, though. It's an ongoing rigorous collaboration with monthly meetings and regular check-ins and surveys with Diversity Lab. So the firms are accountable to the other firms and to Diversity Lab. Again, there are other ways to construct this. So I don't want to say the Mansfield rule is the only way or should be the only piece of a DEI strategy, but I just want to highlight that a couple of reasons why I think it's effective and that I think those elements should be built in to a firm's approach to DEI. And the other thing I'd say is to start small. With the Mansfield rule, we did start small. With all of our projects, we tend to start a little bit small and do a pilot with a smaller number of firms, and we don't build in every single bell and whistle. And I think that firms tend to want to conquer the world, you know, in one fell swoop, where I think it's better to start with one or two achievable goals in your first year and then map out a plan to build towards and work towards your added goals. If you cram everything in there all at once, whatever you're trying to do will probably collapse under its own weight. So I think that would be my other piece of business advice.
Gotcha. So can you talk a little bit about the role that clients can provide? I mean, some companies have been historically been very active in pushing for diverse teams of lawyers to represent them on certain matters. What's a way to kind of encourage more clients to start doing this?
I think clients really have to, there are a lot of clients that really see the value in having more diverse teams. I think, you know, we are very lucky to work with a lot of legal departments as well as law firms that are dedicated to, they view their outside counsel as sort of extensions of their own organization at some level. So the DEI commitment that they have, they want their outside counsel firms to have as well. So, and I think that needs to happen in the realm of asking people to, and telling their outside counsel teams, you know, as part of working with us, you need to show us that you're dedicated to making actionable change within your own firm. I don't know that you can force an organization that's not already doing that to take that seriously. But I think what we are seeing is that more and more companies are seeing the value that working with outside counsel that have diverse teams makes. I mean, they're more likely to have bring more innovative solutions to the table, to have more productive discussions. It is something that is at top of mind for a lot of organizations.
And to wrap up, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
They can go to our Diversity Lab website. They're welcome to email me. I am at lisa@diversitylab.com. We have very easy email addresses to remember. So happy to hear from anyone who'd like to learn more.
And I'd be happy to be emailed as well. I'm Kavita, kavita@diversitylab.com.
Great. Thanks again for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to hear more, please go to your favorite app and check out some other titles from Legal Talk Network. In the meantime, I'm Victor Lee, and I'll see you next time on the ABA Journal Legal Rebels podcast.
If you'd like more information about today's show, please visit LegalRebels.com, LegalTalkNetwork.com, subscribe via iTunes and RSS, find both the ABA Journal and Legal Talk Network on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn, or download the free apps from ABA Journal and Legal Talk Network in Google Play and iTunes. The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by, Legal Talk Network, its officers, directors, employees, agents, representatives, shareholders, and subsidiaries. None of the content should be considered legal advice. As always, consult a lawyer.